Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots with between our well-being, our individual, community, societal, and global well-being, and all of the different things that are going on in our society. Today, I want to cut to the chase because I'm very excited about today's show and the guests that we have. Joining us first will be Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. And, you know, I just want to say that Lori is I'm just so honored to have her on the show. She has directed Public Citizens Global Trade Watch since 1995. She's an expert on trade deals and the outcome of their policies for, as you can well see, over a decade or more. She's made numerous national media appearances and really has played a major role in working around the media shutdown around covering these deals in depth to, you know, reach out to the American people and get people involved and activated and aware of what the trade deals represent. And in case you're not aware of it, on this week's show, we'll have very good news, which I will allow Lori herself to deliver, even though it's going to be, you know, tempered by our current concerns about what will happen in the next administration. You know, I just can't say enough about Lori's tremendous work, but I want her to make the announcement and offer her view of what's going on now with the TPP, which we had projected for over a year would be coming up in the lame duck Congress. Welcome, Lori Wallach, to Connect the Dots. So happy to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Allison, for all your great work fighting the TPP. Well, what I can tell your listeners is that after 6 years of relentless strategic campaigning by progressive activist organizations united across borders through the TPP countries, the TPP is on its last legs, and we can celebrate in this otherwise grim time a victory in that the Republican congressional leaders and President Obama have admitted they do not have the votes to pass the TPP. They will not be bringing it up in the lame duck session of Congress. We have won our goal of making sure the TPP was not approved and implemented. And given 6 years ago when we all started this, everyone thought that was a fool's errand, we should, especially at this moment, really, really honor the achievement of people power that overwhelmed the united forces of a U.S. president, congressional leaders, and the entire corporate lobby to fight back against the expansion of corporate power. That's something we're going to face going forward. It's something we just achieved.
Where are we now with both the trade deals and what the lessons of this hard work and hard-won victory can teach us about how we go forward?
Where we are now is that people in the United States should feel that they have accomplished an enormous amount. Activists like yourself, your listeners, people who use progressive radio, people who use their community organizations to get around the blackout of the mainstream media, to get the word out, to organize, to activate. Where we are now is just without doubt, there is not a majority in Congress, and there was not since the TPP was signed and ready for passage in February of this year. This President Obama relentlessly pushing the TPP through the election may have helped elect Donald Trump, but Trump did not stop the TPP in the U.S. Congress. People power did. People power over years. And the writing was on the wall when they couldn't have the vote after it was signed for this entire session of Congress. So I think as we're going forward, what we need to think about is making sure the next Congress does not want to try to figure out some way to bring up a zombie TPP. It has to be sent to Congress by a president. And although President-elect Trump has said all kinds of critical things about the TPP in specific. He will rip it up in his first 100 days. And about our trade policy in general, and listed a lot of things that he intends to do to change it. I think it remains to be seen what actually happens. If, in fact, in the first 100 days, then-President Trump withdraws the United States signature from TPP, we can all breathe a sigh of relief about TPP. But seeing the list of people that he is starting to nominate to head various government agencies, there are a lot of people who are great boosters of the status quo of corporate empowering so-called trade deals. And so we are going to have to stay on our toes to make sure those guys don't figure out a way to weasel back into place the old agenda. But also, the thing is, the road forward involves also stopping, getting rid of the existing agreements. Because if you think of what we've achieved, we stopped something that was much, much worse, a tsunami of bad that would have drowned us all. But we're still up to our chest in danger from the existing agreements and in loss of jobs, of food safety. And we need to basically figure out how to roll back the parts of those agreements that have nothing to do with trade. We all don't have a fight with trade. If these trade agreements were about trade, we wouldn't have to be messing with them. The problem is all the other corporate baggage that hitched a ride in the name of the use and abuse of the idea of trade. So recently, we, Allison, published a paper. Jared Bernstein, Vice President Biden's former chief economist, and I, and it's called The New Rules of the Road. The easiest way for folks to find it, because the web address on Jared's blog is long, is just do Jared Laurie New Rules of the Road on Trade in Google, and you will find a layout of what should be in all of our agreements, what shouldn't be in any of our agreements, and what kind of reforms we need for transparency and procedures.
Now, that's really brilliant because, you know, part of the thing, part of the initial uphill battle in raising public awareness was Obama's espousal of the deals, which, you know, many people couldn't understand why anything would be wrong. Then we had the media blackout, and the third factor was the complexity of the deals. There's just a natural sense of this is too complicated for me to unravel and understand. I'll leave it to the authorities. So it is invaluable, Lori, that you and Jared have created this, which is a roadmap of what a good deal should look like. So, again, it's not that we're knocking business or trade. It's just that this is a bad deal, a very bad deal for the people and for the earth, because we do a lot of environmental reporting here on Connect the Dots. And so, you know, I think it's so constructive for us to be able to say, this is what a good deal looks like. Let's promote a good deal. So I do invite listeners to go and check that out right away. What about other trade agreements that could be coming down the pipeline toward us? Is it, if the TPP does not go through, is withdrawn, is changed, how does that affect the other subsequent trade agreements, such as the TTIP and the TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement? How will those be affected if we do succeed in permanently stopping the TPP?
Yep. So the paper that Jared and I wrote, just to flag that, is to be the accessible version of what another version of trade could be. And I want to just say up front, we don't have the only way to do it. The point of writing that paper was to lay out, it depends what you're trying to do in how the rules get played out. So we wrote down the kind of things you do if you were trying to put people on the planet first, not put individual corporations' narrow interests first, which is what our current agreements do. But there are lots of different takes. I just want to flag, because I know a lot of the folks who listen to you care a lot about the climate fight, that today Sierra Club is doing a teleconference and releasing a paper that will be up on its website that is what trade rules would look like if you put climate first. And there is a piece of legislation from a couple years ago called the Trade Reform, Accountability, Development, and Employment Act, TRADE Act, that puts basically U.S. broad public interest first, and it was an entire 80 pages alternative approach to trade. So I want to just throw out there that while the proponents of the TPP and corporate Trojan horse agreements that really are just corporate empowerment tools say there is no alternative. They you can see in the New York Times today, it's either we do TPP or there'll be no trade. It's ridiculousness. In fact, trade is not going to stop because there's no TPP. The question is, what are the rules of globalization and stopping the TPP rules and doing something else that prioritizes people and the planet has got to be the forward mission. And so, you know, you said, what about these other agreements? Right now, the U.S. is engaged in negotiations and all those other agreements, which are on that same old corporations first model. So what we need to see is what a future U.S. president, it's going to be a President Trump, says he's going to do with those. Because this trade and services agreement would be a disaster for the climate, for climate and for policies we need to deal with energy efficiency, to promote non-carbon fuel, that would undermine financial regulation. It digs into health and healthcare and health insurance. It digs into education and education policy. And again, it's just a corporate empowerment tool. That's who's been at the table. The TTIP, the European agreement, is like TPP for Europe. At its heart is the investor state system, that system under which were TTIP to go into effect, more than 30,000 new European corporations who have subsidiaries in the U.S. would be empowered to sue the U.S. government in front of three corporate attorneys, who would be empowered to order payment by us, the taxpayers, of unlimited sums, including for those corporations' future expected profits, if they could convince the lawyers that some U.S. federal, state, or local law, regulation, or court ruling undermine the new rights for foreign investors that TTIP would grant them. That agreement is very much like TPP, but it's not negotiated fully yet. It's two-thirds done. And whether the Trump administration continues in it is an open question. And finally, one you didn't mention that is very scarifying is a U.S.-China bilateral investment treaty. It's the one agreement the Obama administration hopes to sign before they leave. 50-50 odds on that. But what it would do is take the investor state mechanism and give it to China, vis-a-vis U.S. policies, and give Chinese state-owned enterprises and other firms new rights to operate and own within the U.S. Ostensibly, it's to give those rights to U.S. firms operating in China, but it's a two-way street, which is the point the negotiators are not paying attention to. So all of that and what happens with those negotiations is going to depend on the next administration, and then whether or not that administration goes forward with those negotiations, then it could become a domestic fight.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just thank you for that absolutely terrific summary. So I think everyone listening can know that we need to stay involved with Global Trade Watch and other activist organizations because all of this is still unfolding and our voices will need to be heard. You know, one of the things that struck me over the many years that we've been talking about this horrible global corporate court and now the horror, it being shared with China when we had been told all along that the TPP was intended to protect Americans and, you know, the U.S. from China. So that's a kind of baffling initiative and turnaround. But one of the things that I hear from people most often is, isn't this unconstitutional? They can't believe that our sacrificing our rights and sovereignty to an international court could just happen, and that the U.S. courts would not, say this is illegal, it's unconstitutional. You know, I hear that pushback of disbelief that this could be happening due to that hope that U.S. courts could prevail more often than almost anything else when I share information with people. And as an attorney, what is your comment on, you know, the legal change this represents and the avenues for overturning it through our own legal system? Is that a realistic hope or not?
Well, I'm going to get to that. Let me just jump back to what you said, which is very important for people to understand, which is what this moment is in the arc of this battle. So we went into the fight over TPP knowing that our nation had, if you will, a treatable form of trade agreement cancer. We had in the body politic already the NAFTA, the China-U.S. WTO agreement, a whole set of 25 years of wage suppressing, working people crushing, food safety destroying, planet boiling, bad news trade agreements. We already have that in our system. And the TPP was basically asking us to drink fatal poison immediately by a shot glass. So the shot glass is on the table. It is in a corner someplace. It maybe is going to be thrown away in a safe place to get rid of the poison. We have to watch where that shot glass starts moving. But at the moment, we're not about to be force-fed poison. However, we still have on board a treatable form of trade cancer. And we have to not only make sure we're not going to have any new doses of poison thrown into our faces with TISA, the China bit, or TTIP, but also we need to go treat the problem we have. We need to stop the damage that already is occurring and try and rebuild some of the damage that has been done. And that is why we all need to keep fighting forward. We have won an incredibly important battle. People should feel so empowered when you think what we achieved against all the possible powers of the world, the most mighty forces. And I want to note, a U.S. president, Congress, and all the corporations together, congressional leaders, because we had amazing congressional champions. And there are folks in the New York area who really did yeoman's work. The leadership of Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, who was the most passionate leader and unwilling to stop for any, fearless. All of that is why we won. And we're going to face that scenario going forward of a lot of power against us. And we have to take on the turnaround. It's not good enough that we stop making it worse. We have to fix the problem. So that is why we need to stay engaged. And a lot of the folks who helped design the strategy over the long term that helped shape the fight on TPP are getting together to think about, okay, now how do we most strategically turn around these other pieces that are continually causing damage? Now, as far as investor states, it is not unconstitutional, unfortunately, per se. So there are elements of it that are constitutionally questionable, the most obvious of which is how do you delegate outside of what's called an Article III court, not a court in Article III of the Constitution, not a U.S. court. How do you delegate? How is it constitutional to get to delegate decisions about the legality of U.S. Government actions to a court that is not a U.S. court, and there's a colorable constitutional challenge question like that. The problem is it's not a constitutional challenge that's going to bring down TPP. Investor state. It is challenging agreements like TPP and TTIP and the China bit, and stopping those agreements from going forward, and then getting a U.S. president to give notice of getting out of our existing investor state-enforced agreements. So Todd Tucker, who is with the Roosevelt Institute, wrote a piece that I believe was, I can't remember where it was posted. Google Todd Tucker ISDS and search for this week. He lays out how the president in the future could give notice of getting out of all of our existing investor state agreements. And then what we should do in the meantime, because they all have hangover clauses where they stay in effect for a certain period. Some of them have hangover clauses, not all of them, that keep the investor state in place for a certain period of time. How in the interim, one could try and ameliorate the effects. But it's a political campaign to terminate investor state. We can't rely on the constitutional challenges. So those are worth exploring.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's really helpful because I think, you know, more and more people have been recruited to this, but when people kind of hold back from doing it, you know, they kind of are relying on that, and you're saying, sadly, we can't. It has to go through the political channel.
Not gonna fix it.
Now, I have one more question for you, but I know your time is short. Do you have the time for another question, or do you need to be...
One more.
Okay. Let's just acquaint our listeners, if we can, with how TPP played, from going from being a marginalized issue, not covered in the mainstream media, promoted by the president, in this election, turned out to be a key issue in the election outcome. And I say this as somebody whose entire election or primary and election season coverage focused on explaining the key role of the TPP and urging that the Democratic Party take a more active anti, and the Democratic candidate take a more activated anti-TPP stance rather than merely, kind of giving, word to, I kind of don't oppose it sort of thing. And why that would have, I argued in both of, in the articles I published in both my outlets, that would have made a key difference. And now some pundits are saying that it has. What is your view of that? Did the TPP and opposition to it play a key role in the election outcome?
I think it did. I think that, first of all, let us all be very clear. Trump did not kill the TPP.
Mm-hmm.
The TPP has not had a majority of support in the House of Representatives since the day, in the beginning of February, it was signed, and therefore became available for a vote. There is an entire congressional season, an entire session, from then until Congress left for the elections in September, when that agreement could have been voted on if they had the votes. They did not have the votes in the House of Representatives well before Trump was elected. Now, what effect did the election have on the issue and the issue on the election? If any one presidential candidate can claim a piece of credit for saving us from TPP, it is Bernie Sanders. It was Bernie Sanders raising the TPP issue and forcing Secretary Clinton to take an opposition position that mainstreamed the issue. Had it been just Trump talking about it, had it been even just Sanders on his own, and he wasn't so successful and went away early talking about it, it would not have gotten the kind of mainstream coverage that it got. But rather, Sanders' success connecting to the same feeling of broad transpartisan outrage against a system that is rigged against the interests of most people in favor of a very narrow elite corporate dominating political class that is bipartisan. His harnessing that and the success it brought him electorally meant that he and his fight against TPP mainstreamed, forced Clinton to talk about it, and the issue suddenly was front and center and not dismissible and started getting coverage, but also got raised to the whole country in the debates, etc. Then the question is, what was the effect of TPP on the election? That was the effect of the election on TPP. It got elevated even higher. So the effect of TPP on the election, I would say, is not so much direct TPP, but rather the consequence of the Democratic Party having effectively abandoned the interests of a lot of working class people with respect to the trade policies that past Democratic presidents have put forward, and that then President Obama made front and center of his agenda. If you look at the counties that delivered the victory for Trump, these are counties where white working class voters are prominent, and they are in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and those are counties that the vote was not a racist, xenophobic vote. These are counties, actually, where Obama had his highest percentage of white voters. These are counties that voted overwhelmingly for Obama. And then what happened? Why did Clinton lose them abjectly? If you look at the trends of what issues on exit polls people were talking about, President Obama making TPP the focus of his second term and a relentless focus for the 2 years of the presidential campaign, having the entire cabinet out there campaigning right through June, July, August, September, October. If there was local press about a high-level cabinet official in a local area, it wasn't campaigning for a Democratic candidate. It was pushing TPP. They were all over the country. That effect basically signaled to those white working-class voters who were still furious about NAFTA and Bill Clinton doing that as a Democrat, given the party of the working class since FDR had been the Democrat to working people, all of a sudden here comes another Democrat that they thought was different, that they voted for, doing the same damn thing. And it didn't help that the Democratic candidate this time around already had trust issues about her believability on commitments to positions, but also, and this is no fault of her own, that her last name was Clinton. That's triggering all of that NAFTA resentment once President Obama made it clear Democrats are going to do the same damn thing to working people on trade that Clinton had done. And that, I think, is not a small reason of why people I love and respect, who I have worked with for decades to fight for fair trade, brave union members who are fighting for a better country, either couldn't bring themselves to vote for Clinton. And in a lot of places, you see a huge gap between the vote for president and the vote for a Democratic member of Congress or senator. Or you find, I know some fine people I really love who literally said to me, I'm going to vote for Trump. I dislike him. I think he is vile. I don't believe in anything that he stands for as far as how he talks about people and women and race. But someone's got to throw the equivalent of a human Molotov cocktail into the system, and I hope he makes a difference and it's not worse than having nothing. I mean, that's not how I was thinking, but there's a lot of despair out there, and I think that the notion that President Clinton II might be more of the same on trade became a really key issue, and that you can thank President Obama for.
Well, thank you. That is an amazing and complete summary. And I also, you know, I think those of us from the progressive and liberal classes and you know, movements trying to deliver that message, even to other liberals, and we were castigated as racists, you know, we weren't heard. I certainly, you know, have never been a Trump supporter, never will be. But also through work on this issue, as well as my own history, I have more connection with the working classes, and they aren't all just utterly racist or solely motivated by racism, and that's a kind of a manipulative view and a blind spot, I think, in many who thought that they could, you know, kind of go along with the Democratic Party and lead in this regard. I thank you so much for the terrific time you spent with me and our listeners today on Connect the Dots, as well as for your many years of leadership, of incredible work, guidance, strategy, and understanding around these trade deals, and look forward to working with you more and bringing more people to this movement as we turn this around, stop these trade deals, and craft a form of trade that works for people and for everyone. Thank you for being with me today on Connect the Dots. Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens, Global Trade Watch. Please follow Global Trade Watch on Twitter, online. Actually, Global Trade Watch and Twitter is a font of terrific content and tweets. It's like the best and easiest way to stay on top of this issue. Thank you again, Lori, and Godspeed with everything. We'll keep on fighting together.
And folks, thank you, Allison, and folks, we have a huge fight ahead of us. It's a scarifying, horrifying time right now. Mm-hmm. But sticking together with our brothers and sisters in the other countries, we are the international progressive answer to Trump, and working together across the country, we are going to make sure that we are able to fight for the things we believe in. Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Lori. And thank you, listeners, for listening and staying with me in this terrific first half of Connect the Dots. We're about to bring in our next guest, who has been a previous guest on the program, and Kevin Zeese. And this is a very special show today because I've interviewed many trade experts, many ground, you know, grassroots organizers, and today we're really talking with the leadership of the global trade opposition movement. And my next guest joining me now is Kevin Zeese, the co-director of It's Our Economy, as well as a founder of the terrific informational website and great media source, Popular Resistance, and also the leader, along with Margaret Flowers, of Flush the TPP, one of the main active grassroots movements that helps get the votes to Congress and the people on the streets to bring our win on the TPP to where we are today. Kevin is an attorney who's been a political activist since graduating from George Washington Law School. He advocates for democratizing the economy as co-director of It's Our Economy. He and Margaret Flowers are also co-hosts of a radio program, Clearing the Fog, and just involved with so many things. He's going to be sharing his perspective on where we are today and what we need to do to stay together, act together, and keep moving forward on this and the other urgent initiatives that we'll be facing in the next administration in the time ahead. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Kevin Zeese.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. Go ahead.
So, you know, we've just heard from Lori Wallach, who's kind of given a summary of the fact, you know, of kind of where we are poised, having, you know, made this achievement. I'd love to hear your perspective. You know, you and Margaret Flowers and Flush the TPP were doing major organizing around the, you know, the Flush the TPP No Lame Duck Uprising, which was to, you know, march on Washington and give our public officials down there a message that we are not allowing the rubber stamping and passage of these trade deals in a Congress of elected officials who are, you know, many of whom are moving on beyond government and potentially into corporate jobs. Is the lame duck uprising in any form continuing or being held? Let's get that clear in case people would like to participate.
Yeah, we are actually in the midst of an action camp and series of actions. And we are taking, you know, we used to plan this action camp for many months for the lame duck session to stop the TPP, and on Friday, the night before it started, President Obama finally faced reality, a reality he could have faced a couple of years ago. He does not have the votes in the House in order to make the TPP pass ratification, and he finally gave up, which was a relief. And so he won, and that was like an amazing people-powered victory over the biggest transnational corporations in the world. And so that's the battle of our era, is people versus corporate power and against wealth, and we won. And so I think that's an important thing for us to recognize. We do have power. Now, of course, the corporate media is not going to give the movement the credit for this. We never expect them to. They don't like to admit people have power. They want us all to feel weak. But there's no question that this would have passed. We would have won whether Clinton was elected or whether Trump was elected. We had won this even before the election season began, and just got stronger and stronger as the election season went forward. So we really want people to know they have power when they mobilize and organize and work together in a persistent way. If we don't give up and keep working together, we do win. And there's also no question that during this election, corporate trade became even more toxic. It was already toxic thanks to NAFTA and the leaks about TPP. But you might remember when they finally won Fast Track, it took them years to win Fast Track. They had to compromise, and the compromise, one of the compromises, was to let us see the TPP. And the more people saw it, the stronger we got. And then, of course, because we were able to delay Fast Track, that delayed a lot of the process and forced this into an election year, which just sharpened the perspective, recognizing that TPP really stood for toxic political poison. And you saw it in all the presidential candidates, except for Gary Johnson, who didn't seem to understand it. He called it free trade when it's really corporate trade. He didn't realize it was a crony capitalism on steroids globally. And so he thought this was like a free trade deal, and he believed the marketing, and everyone else understood what it really was. And so you got even Hillary Clinton coming out against it, you know, who used to call it the gold standard. Senator Sanders did a great job in the primaries to force Clinton into that position. She had to recognize the politics of TPP and back all of her support. And then you saw on the Republican side, President-elect Trump, you know, opposing the TPP and solidifying the opposition in the Republican side, because we had already moved the Republicans. They were no longer the unanimous free trade party or unanimous corporate trade party. What they were was a party divided on this issue. And if you remember the fast track fight, there were dozens of Republicans who opposed fast track, and they were able to really make a tough fight for it. And when Boehner finally won fast track, he went for revenge against those who opposed it, and that cost him his job. So the Speaker of the House lost his job over this issue. That sends a message to Paul Ryan, who started to count votes and realized he didn't have them, and also sent a message to every member of Congress. If the Speaker of the House can lose their job, be careful of this issue. And we saw senators like Rob Portman, who had been a U.S. trade rep in the previous administration, we had to come out against it as well in order to keep his job. And so this became politically toxic. And so this was an amazing victory of people overcoming first a corporate media blackout, keeping everybody in the dark about the TPP. And once people started to understand it, we just got stronger and stronger as the process went forward. And I think this kind of global trade is finished. We now need to move to a different kind of trade that really puts people and planet before corporate profits. That's open, that's negotiated in a transparent way, not a secret, not with corporate leaders and lawyers and executives helping to write it, but with people helping to write it. We have need a whole new approach, because these kinds of trade agreements will never pass in the future. And beyond that, we've recognized this is not just about trade. This is about corporate power. And this is about people organizing to get corporate power out of government, build people power, and remake our democracy so that it represents people, not big business. So it's a big opportunity. And we've been doing protests in Washington, D.C. this week. We did one on Monday where we shut down 395. This is the major highway going from the airport to Capitol Hill. We did that as the lame duck session was getting started, to delay members of Congress and their staff and send a message to them about trade and about the direction of the country. We have focused on Trumpism, which to me is just a extreme form of corporatism. He's going to put forward an extreme corporate agenda that we will need to fight every step of the way. People need to be prepared for that and get organized for that. So we want to make sure people saw that. Today will be, and this is not publicly announced, obviously, but I think I can announce it here and feel safe about it. We're going to be going to the Democratic National Committee and moving them out. We have a bunch of people and moving costumes that are going to go inside and start taking their furniture out because the Democratic Party betrayed people. They betrayed their voters. The reason they lost the election is because they put their big business donors ahead of the necessities of people who are struggling. And that's why you saw Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Indiana all go Republican, because the Democrats have left their voters behind.
You know, I mean, if you wouldn't mind, Kevin, I'd love to just get a little bit more into the political, kind of analysis of this, because we're sort of there anyway. So, one of the things that I think is kind of confusing and surprising about this is that with the betrayal by the Democratic elected officials and the infrastructure that really, you know, in the primary superseded the people's voice, by imposing all these super delegates so that, you know, when it came to the roll call at the convention, an ordinary member of the public who hadn't been following the election closely would not have even understood that Bernie Sanders swept, you know, by 60%, 70%, the very states that have now been the ones that, delivered the election to Trump. And so, people that were not following it closely did not understand when they saw, you know, state officials after state officials saying, you know, X number of votes for our next president, et cetera, that in fact that was rolling in superdelegate votes that actually changed the outcome of what the people had actually voted. And so I think we had a lot of Democrats and liberals on both coasts of the country, not yet affected, not in the population affected by NAFTA, and you know, would be affected in the future because of their horrendous environmental provisions by these agreements, as well as the economic deregulation that certain of these treaties would, you know, kind of unfold. But those people were really not in touch, and so they kind of looked at, you know, people going to Trump rallies and, you know, sort of assumed that the entire middle part of the country, you know, was filled to the brim with nothing but hateful bigots. And, you know, and the very real voice of, you know, of the people who were voting in the Democratic Party and who signaled this problem that you describe was never digested or heard either by the DNC or by, you know, many who ran along with it and still have not gotten the message today. And, you know, that leaves us with some divisions in the, you know, progressive liberal wing, some new potential allies that we didn't know we had. I'd love to hear and a landscape of a lot of people arguing and laying blame and, you know, which is very ultimately, I mean, some kind of assessment is in order, but ultimately we need to have that assessment in order to move on in a united way. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that one.
Boy, that's a lot to unpack in that. There's so much to talk about there. you know, Hillary Clinton spent hundreds of millions of dollars to try to turn this race into a campaign about racism and bigotry and misogyny, and certainly Donald Trump gave her a lot of ammunition on that front. But they never faced up to what the real issue was, which was economic insecurity of most Americans. If you look at the statistics on wealth divides, the bottom 50% of the population shares 1% of the wealth. 50%
wow.
gets 1%. Mm. That shows a pretty serious economic insecurity. And unfortunately, Obama is very much a corporate Democrat who pushed policies that made that worse. The wealth divide got worse under Obama. You saw 97% of the gains in income, the GDP, go to the top 5%, and so the wealth divide got bigger. His health care program, the ACA, was abysmal. It was never going to work. It was always a bailout for those who profit from health care and not a bailout for the people who need health care. And so the Democrats have still not faced up to that. They're still, you know, calling, focusing on Trump's race issues rather than focusing on the economic issues where they failed. And it's kind of amazing to think, that the Democrats became so strong advocating the TPP after the NAFTA hit the United States, you know. And so the failure of trade, corporate trade, became obvious to everyone in the United States. And President Obama made like it the signature issue during the campaign season. It was almost like a suicidal act. Maybe, I don't know if he was trying to undermine Hillary, but he basically gave three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, that always go Democrat, to Trump by making TPP the centerpiece of his advocacy for the last year. It made no sense to voters who are suffering the realities of this unfair economy. So the Democrats need to wake up. I hope they aren't believing their own propaganda, because if they're not facing up to the reality of what they've done to the American people with their economic policies, their Wall Street-based economic policies, they're going to keep losing. Economics is the key. And now you see them on Dapple. You know, you see all these Democrat nonprofit advocates, you know, now speaking about Dapple and almost setting it up for blaming Trump when it fails. But Dapple's almost, the pipeline's almost complete.
Mm-hmm.
That was all done under Obama. He has laid more carbon pipeline, you know, and other infrastructure than any president. So while they're going to set themselves up, the Democrats, to make oil and gas the issue they go after Trump on, and he's going to be terrible on those issues. Don't get me wrong. He's going to be terrible. The reality is the Democrats and their all of above energy strategy have really put us over the tipping point. We're getting worse and worse information now about where we are in climate and the impact it's going to have, because President Obama, like his predecessor, President Bush, missed the opportunity to do what's necessary. And as a result, we're worse off, but they're setting themselves up to blame it on Trump. And Trump will definitely make the problem worse, because that's where his perspective is. But the people need to remember, the Democrats are not the solution. That's what I worry about with where we are as a movement. And I know it's not a popular thing to say right now, because so many people are focused on Trump and what he's bringing to the White House, and there's good reason for that. We did our first protest, was a Stop Trumpism protest, and we're going to do another protest today in front of the Trump Hotel with a big elephant and a little set up a little living room, and say the elephant's going to say racism on it. So we're not letting Trump off the hook, but the DNC is also on the hook. The Democrats are on the hook. They rigged their nomination process to knock out the populist candidate Bernie Sanders, who would have been in a good position to defeat Trump, and because he was an outsider too, and this was an outsider election. And instead they cheated. You know, Don Brazil, the current DNC chair, who should be immediately kicked out, leaked questions to him to Hillary Clinton for debates. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who had been a co-chair of Clinton's previous campaign in 2008 and went on to become a co-chair of the current campaign after she was kicked out of the DNC. You know, they were on the side of Clinton the whole way through. You know, right from the beginning, before the first primary, all over the country, Democratic parties made a relationship with Hillary Clinton where they would share the money she raised. And so they were all in the bag for Hillary. And that kind of corruption inside the Democratic Party is one reason why they lost. They have a lot to face up to. And my sense is they're not facing up to it. My sense is it's going to be Trump's a racist. Look how terrible he is. As a, you know, a bigot, anti-female, anti-Muslim, anti-black, anti-Latino. They're going to focus on that and not look in the mirror at themselves. And they need to look in the mirror, because they got some serious, serious problems. They need to kill Clintonism, and that means kill corporate control of their party.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, one of the things that, I mean, and this is, I don't know what we do about this other than, you know, to do the kind of event like what you're doing. But, you know, part of the problem is that, ironically, while undermining the economic infrastructure that supports the people of our society, they have positioned themselves as, you know, and even after, you know, building the prison system, you know, and all of that, and empowering that, and still, you know, there's a lot of investment in the private prison system. There's a yeah. lot of sending of poor and minorities to war. You know, they're not really a friend to minorities, and yet they have somehow perceptually positioned themselves. And of course, it's very easy to do, given, you know, the Republicans' poor stance on these issues, as the party, you know, of all people and of the defense of minorities. And so a lot of people who are part of minority groups or women are, you know, have close friends and family members, or, you know, people of color or whatever, are clinging to this shred of hope. You know, that will protect our civil liberties by clinging to the Democratic Party like a sinking ship. I'd love your, you know, and, yeah. and the fact is the whole election was divided around that issue by virtue of Trump's candidacy, which we have learned through WikiLeaks, was promoted in the media from the outset by, you know, some of the Clinton side's extensive media relations, and that he may never have even gained traction were it not for that help. So, you know, how do we recruit back some of the people who have been, you know, kind of targeted and captured, you know, by the defense of civil liberties that has been, you know, the kind of big circus of this campaign?
Yeah. We have a very sick democracy. It really is more of a mirage democracy than a real democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Here we had this year the two most unpopular presidential nominees in history. And yet they were able to shut out alternative candidates like Jill Stein from the debates. And they do it with such hubris. They create their own corporation and label it a commission when it's really just a corporation. It's not a commission of any sort. And that commission decides who gets in the debates. So Democrats and Republicans decide that Democrats and Republicans get in the debates and nobody else. It's totally corrupt. And so they shut out alternative voices. People didn't even know Jill Stein was running. If they had heard what she stood for, they would realize that she stood for them more than any candidate running on both foreign and domestic policy. She was even better than Bernie. And so we live in a manipulated election system where we've consistently had, I can't remember a time when we've had, maybe back to McGovern, but had a candidate who actually stood for what people believed in. It's always been two oligarch candidates against each other. Either way, it turns out the people lose. And so the people have a responsibility here. We have to see through this incredible corporate media propaganda machine that makes it about the two parties only, that plays along with the fake debate commission and the other barriers put in place against alternatives to the two parties. And they have to wake up. They have to stop voting lesser evil. Lesser evil voting got us the two worst candidates. It got us Donald Trump, the worst candidate, the most unpopular candidate in history. And so a lot of this falls on the people to wake up. And so that's part of our job. That's why we're not just focusing on Trump in these protests, but also on the DNC and the Democratic Party, because people have to realize that the solution to Donald Trump is not electing a Democrat.
Let me ask you something, Kevin, because a lot of people right now are terrified. Anyone who's been subject to abusive behavior, who has been subject to prejudice, I know large swaths of the population, and they turn around and they want to blame Jill Stein voters. for this outcome. And they were cautioning against it. This is going to be another Nader. And there's this whole, when I look at the numbers, I don't see the votes for Stein that were documented as costing Clinton the election. What do you
see? Not at all. If you look at the results, what really cost Clinton the election was two things. One, many Democrats just did not vote. They could not bring themselves to vote for either candidate, including their own party's nominee. They just stayed home. Second, a lot of people who voted for President Obama in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania and Ohio and even Indiana, President Obama won his first race, Michigan, all these voters who voted for Obama to become president, many of them went to Donald Trump because President Obama was putting out an economic message for Wall Street. This was a populist campaign. You saw it in both parties. Populism divided both parties. It'll be interesting to see in the Republican Party how long they continue to support Trump, but because his views are not the views of their donors, at least not right now. We'll see what comes out. I mean, his economic plan will certainly help their donors because it's an economic plan that continues to funnel money to the top. But opposing a trade agreement like that is not what the donors of the Republican Party wanted. So populism in the Republican side defeated every elected Republican who ran for presidency. It defeated the Bush dynasty. And then in the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders was defeating Hillary Clinton throughout the country, and it hadn't been for the corruption of the DNC putting their thumb on the scale and helping Clinton, he probably would have won that nomination. So you have two parties that were divided between their corporate establishment candidates versus two populist candidates. When he got to the general election, it was the most establishment candidate possible in Hillary Clinton, and the fake, I would call him a fake populist, fake outsider, a billionaire oligarch who used populist language, and he became the outsider who won the election. So it's going to be interesting to see how those divides develop. I'm sure a lot of Democrats, are going to resist making change. They're going to say, we got the most votes. We're not that far off. you know, Trump, blah, 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 and the Greens, and blame others, and the FBI, it's not our fault. And they're not going to, you know, just like with Nader was a scapegoat that allowed the Democrats to look in the mirror at themselves. Because the reality in Florida was that hundreds of thousands of Democrats did not vote for Al Gore. They voted for George Bush. Hundreds of thousands of self-described liberals did not vote for Al Gore. They voted for George Bush. And hundreds of thousands of more Democrats stayed home because they couldn't vote for Al Gore. And yet they blame the tens of thousands of voters who voted for Nader. It's a joke. But it's a joke that people have been fooled by for a long time, including the Democrats. Rather than look in the mirror and say, why did we lose? Why did we not? They go instead. If they looked in the mirror, they would have said, because Al Gore was a corporate candidate who supported every war since Vietnam. He picked Joe Lieberman as vice president, who's even a more corporate, more pro-war candidate. They picked two people who are against what people want. They don't want corporate government. They don't want militarism. And yet that's what the Democrats gave them. So rather than looking in the mirror and seeing reality, they keep repeating the same mistake. President Obama was very artful and great rhetoric. Being African-American, he was able to get through that, even though he also was a corporate candidate, very much a Wall Street candidate. He was able to hide that, and people thought he had no record, you know, that people could point to. He was a new senator, and so he was able to hide his corporate, unless you listen closely and look at his record as a state senator, where he was heavily supported by corporations, especially the nuclear energy industry. If you look at that, you know, he sounded good, and so he got through it as a populist when he really wasn't. He was another fake populist, which I expect we'll see Donald Trump is as well. But the issue is people want government for them, not for corporations, and that's what this TPP battle shows, and that's what we need to build on.
So people can keep in touch with your work and ongoing initiatives at Flush the TPP and Popular Resistance. Kevin Zeese, and we'll have you and Margaret on again. Good luck with, I love that you're training people down in Washington and confronting all those who need to be confronted. Thank you for your incredible work and your analysis today of this very complex and confusing election. And thank you, listeners.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin, so much. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.